My name is Ronnie Davidowitz. I am the head of the New York Trust and Estates Group for Catton Rich and Rosamond, one of the hosts of this seminar. To my immediate left is Scott Bittman, who is a partner in Burden LLP's tax department. Scott has a specialty in trust and estate taxation and planning, with an eye on how changes in tax laws or shifts in the financial market may affect clients. Scott and I have worked together over the many years, and I will tell you this is not in the written material, that he's an absolute pleasure to work with. And that's it. Your mother called me in advance. But Scott is truly a gentleman to work with. He assists in building, preserving, and transferring wealth. As one of the leaders of Burden's Personal Wealth Consulting Group, he does work closely with high-net-worth individuals and family-owned, owner-managed business clients. And he advises on the estate and income tax issues, succession, and financial planning. And just a little bit about Burden itself, is consistently ranked by trade and consumer publications among the nation's top CPA and advisory firms, with nearly 400 professionals and staff at offices in New York City and Jericho, Long Island. And it gives clients access to a comprehensive array of accounting, tax, financial, and management advisory services. And basically advise on every aspect of business at any stage of development, to start up through growth and diversification to transition. And speaking with your colleague, Paul, I also know you do business valuation. So there's a whole potpourri of services. And then to Scott's left, we are joined by John Cunningham, who is the Senior Vice President of one of our other sponsors here, Alliance Retirement Services Group and Life Division, and he covers in the Northeast area. John's team focuses on providing clients with life insurance, disability income protection, annuities, education funding, business and estate planning, and investment products. The team also offers retirement planning and funding. And, of course, a word about Alliance. Alliance Insurance Services is a national full-service insurance brokerage firm for property and casualty, employee benefits, surety, workers' compensation, and financial services. Alliance is a premier U.S. specialty brokerage firm, and it's unparalleled in its service, expertise, and risk solutions. They are headquartered in Newport Beach, California, and probably some of you wish you were there right now, I understand, and are employee-owned in financial partnership with the Blackstone Group. I know that we are really appreciative that you're here and support and participating, because they're very busy, among other things, processing a lot of claims given the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. And I'm almost embarrassed to have taken you away from that because of the need for people. So get to work after this,
right,
real fast. And, of course, what's a, you know, a presentation without my having a chance to just tell you two words about my firm, which is Catton, Mutch, and Rosamond. We are a full-service nationwide firm, and also with offices overseas in London and Shanghai. But we are nationwide with services here in New York, in Chicago, in California, in Washington, D.C., and in Charlotte, North Carolina. And with that, our reach is pretty extensive, and we really cover just about every area of law. We are receiving awards and recognition continually, and we do pride ourselves in client services in all areas of the law. My group is a trust and estates group. We are one of the largest trust and estates groups, and we do the full service of trust and estates. We do the pre- and post-mortem tax planning. We do trust and estate administration, and unique probably to many larger firms, we also do trust and estates litigation. So with that, I think with the doing the multiple of services, it really gives us an appreciation for each area of the law. And with that, gives us, I hope, the sensitivity of, for example, drafting documents that will not lead down the road to litigation, or if they are, because can't always prevent it, that at least they are structured in such a way as to ensure that the particular client's wishes are ultimately carried out. So enough of commercials. Let's get down to why you're here. And with that, we're going to start off with Scott giving us some updates and maybe his crystal ball's working today. Let's see.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. Let's do a little recap of where we're at in terms of income taxes. If nothing is done before the end of the year, the so-called Bush tax cuts are expected to expire. So what does that mean to us in terms of tax rates? The top rates for individuals goes up from 35% to 39.6%. The top capital gains rates goes up from 15% to 20%. And the tax on qualified dividends, the top rate goes up from 15% to 39.6%. In addition to that, we have a whole bunch of tax extenders like the modest 2% payroll tax cut that are set to expire, plus a whole bunch of other things, AMT patches, all kinds of stuff that I'm not going to bore you with, but a lot of things that are going to impact everybody, especially this AMT tax, which is very confusing to everyone. And by the way, this tax sunsetting doesn't impact only, quote, wealthy people, you know, married people who earn more than $250,000 a year. This applies to everybody. You know, the tax rates on married people, all kinds of things that were put in 2001 to be helpful, just go by the boards. The 0% capital gain tax rate for lower income people, they're all gone. Nothing is done. So that's something that's not, you know, generally focused on. In addition to that, because of the new Medicare Act, Obamacare, we have this new 3.8% tax on investment income that's set to kick in 2013. And that's going to apply to unearned income, which is basically two classes of types of income. Net investment income, like interest, dividends, capital gains, as well as so-called passive income, which basically is tradable business income, specifically like real estate, that people don't materially participate in. Some of these are technical terms that we're going to get into in a minute. In addition to that, we have this additional 0.9% tax, additional Medicare tax that's supposed to kick in on wages and self-employment income, and that's on the employee share, which is basically 1.45% today on unlimited wages and self-employment income, that's set to kick up to 2.35%. Exceptions to these taxes, like we said, if you're actively involved in trade or businesses, if you're a real estate professional, a couple of the other types of income that don't qualify for these or subject to these taxes are IRA and qualified pension income, as well as non-taxable income like municipal bond interest and build-up on life insurance. So these are important things to be aware of. This tax does only kick in for so-called wealthy people, people who earn more than $200,000 a year if they're single, or $250,000 a year if they're married. But interestingly, if you take these two sets of things, if they both happen, and you know, I'm sure the Obamacare taxes are going to certainly kick in now that he's been elected president, and the sunset of the Bush tax cuts, we'll talk about in a second how to plan for that, but you know, who knows? But if these things kick in the way we're talking about them, the rates are going to be significantly higher. In our handout in the burden section in part two, we put in this pretty chart which shows what the difference in tax rates are going to be. Because if you layer in the 3.8% tax on unearned income with the increase in the top marginal tax rates, what you will end up with, in effect, is the top marginal tax rate on ordinary income will be 43.4%. The top tax on capital gains will be 23.8%, more than a 50% increase. And the top tax on dividends, qualified dividend income, goes up from 15% all the way up to 43.4%, almost triple. So these are huge things in terms of, trying to think about them and trying to see how we might plan for these things. One other overlay that we all have to be mindful, especially the three of us, because we're very involved in estate planning, is these taxes also apply to trusts and estates. And for trust, the interesting thing is it kicks in at whatever the top marginal rate is for a trust. So that means if we're involved in trusts that have undistributed income in excess of about $12,000 next year, they're going to be subject to these high-level taxes on all undistributed income, something very important to think about and an opportunity to plan for. So this sort of sets the stage for, you know, for what we're going to do. And obviously, we really don't have any idea of what's going to happen, you know, towards the end of the year. You know, I guess, you know, the hope is, we all hope that, you know, that Congress will get its act together and try to do some kind of comprehensive planning, I hope, that deals with tax reform, deals with entitlement reform, and all of those kinds of good things and spending things, so that we could have some kind of an intelligent approach going forward. Meanwhile, we don't know if anything's going to happen before the end of the year. Maybe they'll do some patchwork thing. Maybe they won't do anything. I hope not. Or maybe they'll kick the can down the road and just say that, you know, for the next 6 months or 12 months or whatever, we're just going to sort of let the rates that are in place for 2012 transition into 13 until hopefully we can intelligently attack the thing and do something comprehensive. Somewhere in there is going to be what the answer is. But meanwhile, we're sitting here today, and it's November, and what are you supposed to do? You know, I'm thinking about selling my business. What year should I sell it in? You know, I'm entitled to $1 million bonus at the end of the year, you know. And, you know, what year should I take it in, 2012, 2013? Should I be accelerating deductions, accelerating income? How do I attack this thing? How do you think we should conceptualize it? And these are all, you know, good questions that all of us are facing, and, you know, we face it as planners every day. So how do you attack that? One of the most important things I will tell you, well, it's actually two important, very important things, is you must look at this stuff as to how it applies to you individually. There's no soundbite that you can take away from this that tells you what to do. Because somebody will say, wow, the top marginal rates are going up from 35% to, you know, 39.6 next year. And you're telling me on some types of income, 43.4%. That obviously means I should accelerate income. Well, maybe you're in an alternative minimum tax situation, which means basically you're kind of paying a flat tax of 28%, and maybe accelerating income doesn't affect you. Maybe in 1 year you're selling a principal residence or a piece of rental property, and you're kind of in a 15% marginal bracket in 1 year, and maybe you're in a 43.4% rate in another year. And so you could be like topsy-turvy with this thing. The only way to do intelligent planning is to really sit down with your advisor, take a look at your personal situation, see what your different choices are and things, and see what makes the most sense for you. Can't stress that enough. There's no, you're going to read lots of stuff in the paper, and most of it is soundbites, and you can't conceptualize things like that. And I'll tell you one other thing that I think is very important, and this doesn't have anything to do with what's going on in the world today. It's really a universal kind of thing. People get in trouble when they do planning in vacuums, when their accountant, their insurance person, their trust and estate advisor, and their investment advisors aren't working together to help you in your planning. You know, we have this new law coming into effect, and all of a sudden, this so-called unearned income that we're talking about, I'm telling you, is going to be taxed at much higher marginal rates, maybe dividends, I don't know. And, you know, certainly everything is going to be subject to this extra 3.8% in tax. How does that affect your investment portfolio? What should you be thinking about? Everybody should be speaking. If you have significant investment portfolios, you got to be sitting down with your investment advisor, but in conjunction with folks like us, so that we can intelligently collaborate and help you plan to make sure that both from a tax as well as an economic point of view, that things make sense. And everyone has personal biases to this stuff also. We all have different risk tolerance. We all have different cash flow needs. We all have ultimate different liquidity requirements. So all these things have to sort of be combined together, you know, driven by your feelings and your needs to try to figure out what makes the most sense for you. So, you know, there can't be any absolutes like everybody should be investing more in municipal bonds because it's not subject to tax and dividends are a bad thing because they're going to be taxed much higher. First of all, we don't know what that's going to be. We don't know who these rules are going to apply to. And secondly, we never look at stuff just in terms of taxes. You're always looking at stuff from an economic point of view, with an overlay of what the taxes might do to this thing. And if you sit down, you know, with meetings with an accountant, an attorney, and an investment person, and you sort of look at the situation in total, kind of helps you figure out stuff and what might make the most sense.
I couldn't agree more with that. We've been dealing so much with the planning, dealing with the augmented ability to gift, which I'll get into. But what I talk to people and say, I'm likening it to when you get sick and you tell your good friend or neighbor that your back hurts. And then you say, oh, wait a minute. I know my doctor prescribed something, and you go to your medicine cabinet and say, take this. It was good for me. It's not everything that is good for one person is not good for the other. And if there'll be anything that comes out of this in particular, it's what Scott has said. It is an individual process. And part of it is, of course, tax-driven. That's what brings you to the table. But don't lose the forest through the trees, because taxes are one aspect of it. The other is your own personal needs that are personal to you, because each person sitting here is a different person with different family needs, different obligations, different projections of obligations and the like. So it really needs to be custom made, but with the team effort. I agree.
I'll give you a couple of other examples. I had one man come in, met with us a couple of weeks ago. He's someone that I'm very close to. I've been working with him for 25 years, and he's getting ready to sell his plumbing business. And it's in an old C corporation, which, I'm not going to bore you with technical details, but from a tax point of view, they're not that good to have. They have all kinds of overlays and tax complications. So we're taking a look at this, and he says, I'm not sure I'm going to be in business another year or two, and, what should we be thinking about? I'm not sure how to approach this stuff. And we took a look at the situation, and we saw that he had a lot of money embedded in the C corporation that he was holding, sort of using it for working capital, and he owns 100% of the business. He inherited it like 40 years ago from his uncle, and he wasn't 100% sure what he was going to do with the business, but he's pretty much thinking he wanted to sell it. But there's not a lot of time before the end of the year to sell the thing, close the transaction, whatever. And he's afraid because I'm telling him that the capital gain rate is going to go up by more than 50%, and he sells it for a few million dollars. It's a lot of money to him. So one thing we came up with is we said, why don't we take a dividend and pull out the $2.5 million that's embedded in there today? You're telling me you don't need the money for working capital, and by pulling the money out today, we lock in that he pays tax at the still advantageous qualified dividend rates of 15%. We know rates aren't going to be any lower than that. So if he pulls that out today, that gives him time to find a qualified buyer, not to get into a time-sensitive crisis thing, and he saves hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes. So that's an example of how when you sit with someone and you listen to them, listen to the story. What am I trying to accomplish? Who am I? What do I need to do? You can come up with interesting, solutions for people. I mean, you're not going to read about something like that in the paper. It's just, it's an individual thing that makes sense to this person. But that's why it's important just to sit and listen and understand. You read about other things. This might be a great time to take your IRA and convert it into a Roth IRA and do something like that. Well, that's certainly worth exploring, but in my experience, when I've looked at these things, in most situations, it has not been a good idea to convert an IRA or a qualified pension into a Roth. And the reason for that, just getting down to the basics, is that I hate putting ourselves in a position, and this is even if rates go up, I hate putting ourselves in a position to pay taxes today when they may not be due for many, many years or decades. If you're sitting there and you're saying, I'm looking to sell a business and the decision is I'm going to sell it in 2012 or 2013, then it becomes easy. Rates are only going to go up. They're not going to go down. If you pay taxes a year or two early, the time value of money is not that great. So who cares if I pay the taxes a little early? If I lock in and I save a lot of money because maybe the rates are going to go up for, quote, higher income people, whatever that means, then that's fine. But if I'm making it, don't sell stock to trigger gains without looking at what it does to the portfolio and just to get a higher basis in the asset when maybe economically I would be holding on to the stocks for many, many years. But in situations where it's one year or another, if somebody tells me I have the ability to take $1 million bonus and it's going to be in December or January, that becomes easy now in most cases, and you can't be absolute about that either. But if you take it in December, you avoid this add-on 0.9% Medicare tax that I know is kicking in, you know, and maybe you save, you know, the increase in the top marginal rates if that affects you. So that's kind of how we attack looking at stuff, you know, just a couple of examples of things I'm seeing. And I'm sure over the next few weeks, we're going to come across many, many more specific situations where we're going to just sit down and, you know, and help people. One other area that you're not going to see discussed a lot that I think is huge. I know it is for a lot of our clients because we have a lot of people in the real estate industry at Burden. Is this, you know, I'll go back to what I was talking about. Remember we said that that passive income is subject to this 3.8% additional Medicare tax. It's a funny thing. In 1986, in the tax law, this term passive income, you know, came into effect. And what it was the government was trying to come in and stop people from being able to deduct losses from so-called tax shelters against their wage and other interest and dividend income. So they put stuff into the legislation that said if you don't, quote, materially participate in an activity, that we're not going to let you deduct the losses up front. We're going to allow you to take them, and they're going to be frozen, and then they get freed up over time as you generate, quote, passive income. So it was something put in the law, you know, for that effect. So what we've been looking at over the last 20 years, basically, you know, trying to figure out ways to have people be considered as if they materially participate, to free up losses if they had them, you know, especially in the real estate industry from depreciation or, you know, or whatever. And you looked at it that way. But we didn't pay attention to a lot of people who didn't materially participate and had income from these activities, you know, because it just didn't make a difference. What's the difference if you have passive income? It got taxed at the top ordinary income rates, and it didn't matter. Well, now it matters. If you have to pay an extra 3.8% income on this real estate income that you don't devote a lot of energy to, and just without getting into all kinds of technical stuff, basically, you know, considered materially participating or being active in a trade or business is if you really spend time doing it 500 hours a year or more. And if you're in the real estate industry, you know, they have these other more convoluted real estate professional rules that I'm really not going to get into. But in that kind of situation, in order to be considered a real estate professional, you have to spend at least 750 hours a year in the real estate industry, and then you have to aggregate all your activities together. And this is a lot of tax compliance, but you have to go through all these hoops in order to position yourself to be considered a real estate professional. Nobody paid a lot of attention to this, people that had positive income, because it just didn't make a difference. And now it's going to make a difference to a lot of people, especially a lot of our clients. So what we've been doing in this area is we were trying to anticipate that the Obamacare tax, this 3.8% tax, was going to come into being, and we were trying to position people who had positive income to be in a situation where they wouldn't be subject to this tax. And what that means is you really drill down, you take a look at how people are spending their time, they keep diaries, and you try to document how people are devoting their energy so that you can come in and prove to people that you were a real estate professional, that you do materially participate in trades or businesses. We did this in a very limited setting up until this point because you had to have someone who had tax losses in order to do this. But now you have a whole wide spectrum of people that are going to be subject to these rules. So what we did on the 2011 tax returns, and we're going to continue to do in 2012, is we're going to talk to our clients who are in positions where this may be applicable, and we're going to try to make these elections, try to make sure that the documentation is in place, because this could save a lot of money. If you had $1 million of rental real estate income, you know, paying or not paying a tax at 3.8% has a huge impact, but you can't just do it. You have to make sure that, you know, that you meet these tests and that it makes sense to you. So it's a whole other thing that you're not going to read a lot about, but it's going to impact a significant amount of people. And a funny thing is, in in the area of trusts and estates that Ronnie and I do, this there are no regulations as to how these real estate professional and material participation rules apply to trusts and estates. It's a funny thing. Out of all these years since the law was passed, there's one case, one private letter ruling, and one tax court memorandum. It's astounding. The government has a very difficult time dealing with it, because when you have a trust is a funny kind of an entity, as some of, you know, those of you that are involved in trusts know. A trust isn't like an individual. You have a fiduciary, a trustee, who is legally responsible to take care of beneficiaries. Some of them are lifetime beneficiaries, some of them are remainder beneficiaries. So who's the taxpayer? Who's supposed to materially participate? The corporate trustee, the beneficiary, you know, the person that set up the trust. You know, and the government, it's very difficult for them to apply these rules to trust. But we represent lots of trusts. Like, you know, let's say that you had, the founder of a real estate empire and, passed away and set up a trust for his surviving spouse. And it's got, you know, $500 million of real estate in there. And, you know, you have this trust that's set up and it's got just a ton of real estate and it's throwing off all kinds of income. How do these rules work for that? Should I distribute income out? Because I just told you that the rates on this tax applies to accumulated income at the trust level if you accumulate more than $12,000. How do these things work? But we're trying to wrestle with all these kinds of things, and, you know, thinking about them now puts us in a position to save tremendous amounts of tax, but it involves intelligent planning and brainstorming and documentation. So
if I could just interrupt, there's actually one other dimension, and we're not going to make this solely real estate, but there is a concept for the state end of things when you have assets that make up more than 35% of your gross estate, that you are able, if they're included in your estate and you don't want to have a forced sale because you're going to be paying estate taxes on all the assets that make up your estate. In the case of, say, having real estate, and if it makes up more than 35% of your gross estate, you can have a deferment on the payment of estate taxes over a period of time. In essence, what you're doing is borrowing from the government, but the play on it is, of course, you're not against forced to do a fire sale with estate taxes due 9 months from death in order to pay the tax man. But the same thing that Scott is talking about applies in the estate tax deferment for tests of real estate, and that is this something that you are actively involved with? So the paper trail and the process that Scott is talking about from an income tax point of view is actually good procedure from a point of view of the state tax deferral under this is a code section 6166.
Yeah, and those rules they're not exactly the same, but they are quite similar, so it is
just good practice, the overlay.
So really the best message I could tell anyone and anyone that you guys know is to really sit down and meet with your advisors and look at your personal situation and make sure that all your advisors are on the same page with trying to talk to you based on what your goals and needs and wishes are, to try to make sure that you have comprehensive plans dealing with these things. Look, you can, you can still be flexible with these things. You can go back and examine your own personal situation and try to tease certain things up. If the government ends up kicking the can down the road and giving us another year on this stuff, you don't necessarily have to execute things and accelerate income into this year if you don't want to. But at least be in a position to act, and then if we know more before the end of the year, you know, that'll obviously help. But if we don't know, well, if things are going to transpire, at least you're in a position to, you know, to do something. And the same thing is going to apply to the, you know, to the stuff that Ronnie and John.
Even at this point, you know, this time of the year is obviously difficult. You lose certainly a week here in November. You lose 2 weeks in December, and so you'll be here before we know it. So starting those conversations is probably, I mean, obviously we've started these conversations months ago with other clients, but now that we have a little bit more clarity in terms of where we're going, the finality of the election kind of creates a little bit more clarity for people.
Equity partners have always been able to get distributed income on a 15% capital.
same. I think the question had to do with, you know, carried interest and how that type of income will be taxed. With President Obama now being as president for the next few years, it's something that he's always proposed, trying to tax this, quote, earned income that was previously taxed at 15%, taxed at ordinary income rates. He's looked at that. Right now it's not in the law, but, you know, who knows? Certainly, I shouldn't say definitely. It's my understanding that that type of income will be subject to this 3.8% unearned income tax. It was meant to be, but it's not 100% clear. So, you know, we're going to have to see. There are really, the unfortunate thing about this 3.8% tax is there are no regulations on there. So there are a lot of embedded questions that we don't know the answer to on how it's going to apply. So, you know, we're going to have to be on the lookout for it.
.9% tax for Medicare. Is that over and above the 3.8 increase? You mentioned something about a 0.9 tax on certain income.
The question was how this 0.9% Medicare tax sort of relates to the 3.8% new Obamacare tax is going to, you know, how they apply. The 3.8% tax applies to investment income, like this passive income and interest and dividend and capital gain type income on non-trades or businesses, for people who have income more than $250,000 a year if they're married. So it applies in that situation. This 0.9% increase is, you know how we have this unlimited tax on wages and SE income for Medicare purposes? It's currently the employee share of that is 1.45%. So on wages and self-employment income, that tax, which was 1.45%, the employee share, or 2.9% with the total employee share, is being increased by another 0.9% for people who either have wages or have self-employment income in excess of $250,000 a year if they're married. So one tax applies to earned income and one tax applies to unearned. So it's a totally separate tax. And this, by the way, is the first time in our history that we've had Social Security Medicare taxes applied to income other than, to income of types other than earned income. So still new thing.
All right, we'll take one last question, and then we'll move on.
If you have losses, is it preferable to take the losses next year when the taxes are a lot higher than this year?
The answer, again, is it depends. The only way, I can't give you an absolute answer. Somebody could say generally, yeah, maybe let's take losses in 2013 because the rates will be higher. But what if the rates aren't higher as to you? You could be projected to be in a 15% marginal tax bracket next year and a 35% marginal tax bracket in 2012. It totally depends on the makeup of your income. So a generality, yeah, it makes sense to accelerate income into 12 and defer deductions into next year. But that may not apply to you, and that's what the trap is. And that's why you have to look at each individual situation and see.
With that, it's my turn. And you can feel free to kibitz with, as I've interfered too. But one or two other just quick alerts. As a result of Hurricane Sandy, IRS did issue a couple of relief items, and I just wanted people to be aware of that. So for those taxpayers that are located in the Northeast area, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, IRS has postponed until February 1 the due date and for Form 990s, that's your private foundation forms and returns, those have been extended. Fourth quarter individual estimated tax payments that would normally have been due on January 15th. You now have a little bit more time to make that payment, and also payroll and excise tax returns. So just be aware that there are a little bit of relief that was extended there? Is there some... I have not seen on the foreign taxpayers, actually.
Yeah, we should look at that. I haven't seen
anything. Not seen anything come down on that. That was a question of whether foreign taxpayers' reporting has been extended. So I am not aware of that. Okay. Income tax we've been talking about. Now we're into my area, gift estate tax. As probably everybody here knows, we had a law that was passed in 2001 that was transitioning estate gift increases. Well, estate increases kept the gift exemption amount at $1 million. We were having a 2010 question mark. As we were approaching 2009, 2010, all of us as practitioners were shaking our head and saying, well, we'll never get to 2009 with the laws it is. We'll never get 2010, not knowing whether there's going to be an estate tax on those who die in 2010. And hate to say it, I was wrong. As were, though, many and all, I think, I can't think of really any of my colleagues.
Everybody.
We thought differently. We just were astounded at the lack of activity and attention to this. And if anything is more proof of this, on December 17, 2010, is when the law was enacted to deal with decedents dying in 2010, to tell us whether or not there would be an estate tax or whether or not you could opt out and have no estate tax apply, obviously federal level I'm talking about, and also what would happen going forward. So Congress, in its infinite wisdom, gave us a two-year window of opportunity, passed the law on December 17, 2010, that in addition to dealing with decedents dying in 2010, for the 2011 and 2012 year, did a number of things, including unified the gift and estate exemption amount, because, for example, in 2009, the gift exemption had been $1 million as the maximum amount that could be transferred without paying a gift tax on the federal level. And on the estate tax amount was $3.5 million. So you had a dichotomy between them. So for 2011-2012, unified. So we are here on November 8th, and until Congress does something further, we have until the end of the year with an exemption amount that had been, for those two-year periods, at a $5 million sum per person, which is an index for inflation number, which means that for 2012, an individual can have exempt from gift tax on the federal level $5,120,000. That is the index for inflation number. Husband and wife, the gift split could do a maximum of $10,240,000. Now, just as is with any kind of gifting, there is an interrelationship between gifts that have been done in previous years with those that you intend to do today or on a going forward basis. So what do I mean by that? If, let's say, you had made gifts in prior years that used up the maximum gift exemption that was available, $1 million, and you are thinking of making the transfer before year end, to take advantage of the $5,120,000, you must reduce from your $5,120,000 the $1 million of exemption that you had previously used up, even if these were gifting over a staggered period of time. And that would mean that you would have available $4,120,000 for gifting. That is also interrelated on the estate end, and I'll get to that when it comes to a potential exposure on clawback, and I'll explain what I mean with that. So you have the interrelationship between the prior gifting and the current gifting. If Congress does nothing, the law is set to expire at the end of the year. which would mean we would be going back to the rate of $1 million gift and estate exemption at a tax rate of 55%. The generation skipping exemption, which is a generation skipping tax, is a tax on transfer of wealth to someone who is two or more generations below you. Think of my grandchildren, and if you do, please do think of my grandchildren. So, but you can, you will have gifting if it goes to that below generations. Also, by the way, anyone who is 37 and a half years younger triggers the generation skipping tax, and it is a separate standalone tax. And that is, if it's, again, if it sunsets with no action, you would have, it's $1 million, but it's an adjustment for inflation factor. So that's actually the number. I think it's going to be about $1,430,000 would be the number. We now have the benefit of at least knowing what the results of the election are. So does that make me any smarter? I wish. I can only tell you what I'm seeing on listserv and what I'm aware of. But with that and whatever it is now, 2.25, I think, gets you on the subway. That's probably as far as I might take it at the moment. But what President Obama had done as part of his budget proposal, and this was pre-election, had wanted the rate to go back to the $3.5 million of estate exemption and $1 million on gift, and with the compromise rate, not quite at the 55%, but maybe more on the 45%. That's a proposal. What we are hearing, and this is, again, just a lot of the gossip coming down in the more recent hours after the election, is that Congress either may do nothing before the year end because of the same spin of trying not to have increases in taxes, so that what would happen is come 2013, at the beginning, you would have something done by the new Congress that would be retroactive to January 1, 2013, that might do just what Scott was saying, of kick the can down the road with a temporary halt or freeze at the current $5 million exemption amount, and probably keeping it at the rate which was put into effect when the law was passed of 35%. As contrasted, again, if the sun sets a 55% tax rate. Or you could have that Congress will do something just, again, with this Band-Aid. The key thing is that estate taxes and gift taxes and generation skipping taxes are part of a congressional overhaul, because what Congress wants to do, and certainly what President Obama has articulated wanting to do, is a major overhaul of the tax code. So they need time to do that and time to deal with all their talk and the like. So that's why you may see yet another Band-Aid, I'll call it, but it may carry us with these higher, what I would have otherwise said and still do say, window of opportunity, augmented exemption amounts for planning and transfer of significant wealth may be extended. Does that mean I can now go out and relax and take some of that pressure off and not do planning to the end of the year? I don't think so, because I can't guarantee this. You know, unless somebody comes down with a pronouncement and we have it from a reliable source that everyone can do it and it gets done, I think that we still need to act, if you are going to act, before end of year, just with the assumption that it may expire. So what are we talking about, and is it for you, and or is it for your clients and the like? And that's really, it goes to Scott's point, it's an individual analysis. Because if you think about it, especially if you're dealing with husband and wife, a $10 million transfer of wealth, that's real money. I don't care who you are or what you are, that's a lot of money. And we're coming out of, and we're in the midst of, and so the way the market went yesterday is another example. We've got a lot of volatility here. We've got uncertain economic times. And I know I am dealing clients who are, in one hand, anxious to take advantage of the window of opportunity, but on the other hand, quite nervous as to whether they should. And the answer is some should, even up to the maximum, if that's the kind of wealth that you have. But Some should not. Some should do some part of it. And because it's $10 million or $5 million, depending on your circumstances, doesn't mean you need to do all of it. Sometimes a portion of it is relevant. So it is an individual process. Now, what are some of the factors that I think go into whether or not it is something for you, whether you should be considering it? I start with a very, very basic premise. If you give it, guess what? You don't have it. And if you have to be comfortable with that. And that is, to me, the very much the starting point. Now, you give it, you don't have it. How does the law work? If you are giving cash or marketable securities, it's very easy. We know what the value is and how to value it. But let's just use that as an example. You're giving $5 million. That's easy. It's an easy decision. We'll talk about whether it goes outright or in trust or the like. If you are dealing with, say, cash equivalent stocks, you want to take a look at what your basis is in that property. It's one of the factors, because when you gift property, what we are looking at is two things. One is, what is the value of the item that you're looking to transfer as of the point of transfer? That's the fair market value. That is what will impact the value of your gift as the donor. And that's what will impact what you are using up in terms of your exemption amount. However, as the recipient, the donee receives the donor's original basis. So what do we mean? Let's use an example. I always find that works best. If the stock is worth $1,000 at the time you're ready to do the transfer, but you paid $100 for it, the donee gets it at the $100 and then will have, if he or she goes to sell it, a capital gain, assuming that it is sold for, say, the $1,000 on the difference between the $1,000 and the $100. So you need to bear this in mind when you're looking at what are reasonable assets to make that transfer. And why is this a consideration? Again, it depends on the individual. Where are we? What the basis is? What's the age? Because when somebody dies, there is, and the asset is included in his or her estate, that same stock that I used as an example, you have what we call an adjustment in basis on death. And what that means is that the value of the asset gets adjusted to the then fair market value as of the decedent's date of death. So you may want to take a look at that, because if, using my same example, at date of death, that same stock was worth $1,000, you would have an adjustment at basis to the $1,000. The heir would get that stock at the $1,000. And then if they sold it at $1,000, you'd have no gain or loss, anything greater than that. You've just reduced the differential. I did use the word adjustment in basis because you do have to be aware that things that we have seen can also go down. It is an adjustment to what the fair market value is. So basis becomes an important consideration as to the assets. I had a gentleman in my office about 2 weeks ago looking to take advantage of the gifting, which he should. He's got that amount of wealth, but we were looking at the makeup of his stock portfolio, because his initial reaction was to just transfer over the entire stock portfolio as part of his makeup of the gift to take advantage of the exemption amount. But he had, as we went through this, quite a number of holdings that had zero basis and had significantly gone up. So when we were looking at it and compared it against other assets that he had, we determined that he should transfer certain of the assets in the portfolio, but the others should be retained for the heirs to have the benefit of adjustment and basis on those. And that's, again, an individual thing. So that's one thing. Another thing is that you're looking at it, as I said, you give it, you don't have it. It's, what are your own financial needs? And I know we do think about it, certainly, in terms of the roof over your head and the food on the table, but it goes far more than that. It's what is your lifestyle? I don't know about you, but I've been working very hard. I enjoy going on a nice trip. I don't want to be hesitant to be able to take that trip. You know, that's part of the consideration.
You don't want to gift it all away.
It's not a matter of gifting at all. It's a matter of feeling that you're strained or hesitant because now you can't stay in that five-star hotel if that's your inclination. That's what you enjoy. Your lifestyle should not be compromised, is my own feeling. Tax planning doesn't happen in that. You like to give monies to charity. It's what you enjoy doing. Well, you shouldn't be compromised in being able to do that on a regular basis because all of a sudden you've given up. And then, of course, worst of all worlds, if you have to go to your children to get some of that money back, it's not a comfortable position. So these are some of the things we also want to look at. And so I think these are some of the considerations and why I say it doesn't happen in a vacuum. But having said that, it is a unique opportunity to do this wealth transfer. So then the question becomes, how do you do it? Give it outright to, say, your children? Well, again, I repeat, it's not an insignificant sum. And remember, money that is outright is in reach of the child's creditor once it's distributed into his hands. Maybe you've got children that are at the age where they haven't yet brought that significant other home, but you don't know who it's going to be, and hopefully you're going to love him or her. Well, it doesn't always work that way, okay? And maybe you'll love them more if you maintain some control. I hate to say it, divorce is a prevalent thing. Money, if it's outright, yes, technically it's viewed as separate property, but it's very easy to commingle property, change the character of that property, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe not every child can manage money properly, so it's not even a prudent thing to do. Maybe you want to do some planning such that not only are you taking advantage of the gift exemption, but you also want to do the generation skipping exemption so that you get two for one, which means you're getting the property that can benefit not only and be available for children, I'll explain that, but also for your grandchildren and future generations. So you can then have both your gift exemption and the generation skipping exemption apply to the transfer of wealth. And certainly if you have younger grandchildren, and depending on what age, it may not be appropriate for them to have access to money or have money directly in their hands at too young an age. I don't know. It's been my experience. It's amazing to see how many young kids absolutely need that fancy car. I mean, not just want it, they need it. So, you know, you want to be careful. And, you know, and certainly as planners, what we are looking at, and the tension is to have the comfort of having money available for our children, our grandchildren, but not at risk of making them productive members of society. So trusts are excellent vehicles. When you do gift the money into, say, a trust, and you've utilized your full generation skipping exemption and gift exemption, not only is the property that has been contributed to the trust going to escape the gift and GST exemption, but so too will the appreciation, the growth on that property. So it is an important thing to consider. Now, one thing that people are talking about doing is having the cake a little bit and eating it too, and that is the safety harbor, because, again, we talk a large sum of money. So one of the things that can be done, or, and you may have heard these terms, last spousal lifetime annuity trust, and these are trusts that are set up. I set up a trust for the benefit of my husband and issue meaning my children, my grandchildren. And what I say is during the life of my husband, my trustee, who cannot have a beneficial interest, you know, I won't get into too many technicalities here, may distribute so much of the income and or principal to any one of my spouse, an issue. And the reason to keep the spouse in is that safety net of assuming it's a good marriage and I behave myself in my example. If there is a need for money, it can be distributed, in my example, to my husband. And as long as we're living together, I get the benefit of the money going to my husband. So that's one of the safety nets. We have been doing them. One thing we're hearing and people are doing, and I've done a few too, is mutual trust. So husband does one with the spouse in mind and wife does one with the husband in mind. One thing you must be very careful of, there is a concept under our law called the reciprocal trust doctrine. And what that means is that you have to differ the terms in those kinds of trust that I was talking about so that they vary. Because if you are as the creator of the trust, and my husband as the creator of his trust, in the exact same economic position as when we started this whole process, IRS will disregard the trust and will just have the property will be in the estate anyway and would not have accomplished. So you need to have variation on terms, and that's just something to be aware of. One thing I do want to mention before I forget is all of our talk here is federal. We have only one state in the United States that has a gift tax, Connecticut. So if you are a Connecticut resident and might be impacted by the Connecticut gift tax, please be careful because the threshold is $2 million. So you got to be aware that if you are going to do planning, that would be taking advantage of the maximum federal amount, you may have a gift implication on the Connecticut state level. You will not have it on the federal level. We'll take the questions there. But the other things that we are doing, because we're in November 8th, and we may run out of time, may not. So, you know, people like me are extremely busy trying to get these trust documents drafted. But the other problem you have is one of what property are you contributing? Because cash, that's easy to value. A dollar is a dollar. All right? So that's, frankly, at this stage of the game, probably the easiest thing. You can still, if you have that available cash in excess of a certain sum, you can park that into a trust and then figure out later on your planning and what you're going to do with that. And some of the things we're seeing, and that'll be something that you may want to go into more, John, but it's also life insurance. So that people are, what they're doing is taking dollars and parking it into an irrevocable life insurance trust. Because if money's held in an irrevocable life insurance trust, that too escapes inclusion in your estate for tax purposes. Or you put it into a trust, and then you can go and use that monies that have gone in to pay premium and get a significant policy. I'm sure you'll go into a little bit more on that.
And usually that's part and not whole, part of the process.
Right. One thing I'm not doing, though, is prepaying the premium in one shot. I'll just say that I would still pay it over the time, even though you want to make your gift now, because the contribution to the trust is the gift element, not the payment of the premium by purchase. So, you know, we have that issue. You know, we really don't know where we're going to be. You have other things that I guess before I get into some of the other estate planning. If you have loans out there for the benefit of your children, those are easy to forgive those loans. Those may be another source for doing a quick transfer of wealth. Okay, so those are things, and our rates are so low that even if on a future going forward, if we say at the end of the day what other planning is going to be there, as the rates are right now so historically low, you still can take quite advantage of loans and transfers. Look at the fact that we have assets that are fairly depressed in value, you can do some transfers here that might be able to take advantage not only of depressed values with the hope that they'll appreciate in value, but also couple that with discounts depending on what you are transferring. So, for example, we go back to what Scott had been talking about in terms of real estate. If you are giving a percentage in a real estate interest or in a limited liability company or in a family limited partnership, and the same thing holds true on business interests and the like, you give a percentage that is less than a majority interest, not only do you have the value as it's determined, but then you have discounts that can be further applied against the percentage that you're looking to transfer for purposes of minority discounts and lack of marketability. So you're leveraging this and able to transfer actually, in effect, more wealth than otherwise. The key here, though, is appraisal, because we need to substantiate the value of those assets, because cash, cash equivalents, easy to value. But when we have the harder to value assets, whether we're talking about real estate, we're talking about art, we're talking about business interests, we need a qualified appraisal. Generally, the service wants them done within 60 days of the time of transfer. That is the preferred time. Well, where are we again? November 8th. The attorneys are busy, the accountants are busy, the insurance people are busy, but still to what the appraisers, very busy. But that doesn't mean it can't happen, because your returns for gift tax returns are not due. The earliest is April 15, 2013 for transfers that would have taken place in 2012, and that's without extension. You go on extension, you have until the fall. So in terms of the final narrative of a qualified appraisal that we would attach to a gift tax return, you don't need that final polished found document until you're filing a gift tax return. But you need to have a sense of the number. So that's the key thing, is to see if the appraiser can give you a comfort level, because you may not want to be out of pocket to pay gift taxes. I mean, I tend to be of the school that Scott's in terms of the reluctance to prepay on any tax. But you, again, if you've determined that you are comfortable enough to take advantage of this. And then just very briefly, whatever we may be, we're still going to have certain estate planning tools very much available to us. We have grant or retained annuity trusts until we see it has been on the priority list from IRS as a target area,
right,
to deal with, to grants or retained annuity trust, where we have been able pre-2011 and 2012 to move significant sums of money, because there are, it's a trust that is established now. You contribute, say, a percentage of money, whether I'm, particularly if I'm able to leverage it with other discounts and the like. I, as the grantor, the person who creates the trust, gets an annuity over a period of time. If I do a two-year grant, it's a two-year term. On the anniversary date, or no later than 105 days from the funding of the grant, the first year, second year, if it's a two-year, you get paid back an annuity. In essence, what you are is you're getting back the value of the property you contributed. And the play is that it's the appreciation that gets passed on a tax-free basis to the next generation. And there's a number of factors that go into seeing whether you've got your home run or not. It's the value of the property that's contributed. It's the term of the years. And it's something called the 75-20 rate, which is a monthly rate published by IRS. For example, for November, that's a 1% rate. 1%, forget the market yesterday, the 1% is not that necessarily challenging a hurdle rate in terms of doing better than, and you might be able to get that appreciation. Now, that's until we hear otherwise. The priority, IRS priority guidance was that I wanted to make the grant with a 10-year term, which would really cut into the efficacy of using a grant. There are other things that we can do. We can do sales on private annuities because of the lower rates. We can do sales to defective trust. So there's a whole host of things that are very much still going to be in play.
But be careful with some of these creative planning things that Ronnie, like, for example, with the discounts. That was one of the things that President Obama put in his budget proposal that he was going to legislate out in the family setting. So while it's very customary, and we do appraisals, you know, Carl and I do them at our firm, you know, it's very customary in the right situation if you give away a minority interest in a, you know, property to get discounts of up to, you know, 30% in certain situations. These things could be legislated out in the family setting. So there are a bunch of things that may not be available to us once we get past the end of the year. We just don't know. And you have to be mindful of
that. Right. With that, that's very true. So the elimination of the discount was really geared towards, at least at the moment, but these are all, remember, these are just wish lists, whether in this case it's the IRS's or Treasury's wish lists, were for non-business-related purposes. So that if you, for instance, and we've seen it where family limited partnerships are set up where they only contain cash and marketable securities, and they have no ostensible business purpose, and the real play was just to get those discounts. Those for sure are on the target list. However, if you have a real estate management or a business interest, and there is a, you still may have the ability to use that. Time will only tell. One thing that has been a challenge in my area is the constant shifting of the sands, whether we're talking about the estate, the gift, the planning. And I think the one thing that we all want as taxpayers is certainty. So what we do, whether we're doing our gifting, we're doing our testamentary-related documents, is we try to keep it as flexible as possible so as to allow for, you know, ability to move with the time. And as much as I like seeing people coming in fairly often, it's, you know, we do think this is the Keep Lawyers in Business Act, but I don't think it's fair. So we try to have as much flexibility as possible. But I've monopolized a lot of time, and we will, but I'd like to do is, in the interest of time, is let John speak, and then we'll invite questions at the end, if I may. So hold your thoughts on that, John. Please.
Okay, great. I know I stand between you and the door, so I understand exactly where I'm at. So don't think I don't recognize that at this point. There's some work. Obviously, we work directly with these two firms, and we have a great relationship. And obviously, between the grass and flats and other different trust items, we're certainly intimately familiar with those and working with Burden and Cat. And so I want to get into deep, but I think one of the things that we want to sort of point out is life insurance is part of that solution and part of the trust. But some of the other, when you get these interest rates environment that is so low and so sustained low for such a long period of time, it's obviously a huge fracture to some of the way the insurance companies and even banks sort of operate, right? The theory is they collect premium in dollars and then they guarantee a small amount and then they go make that money in investment returns and interest. Well, when that interest rates are smaller and the margins are smaller, then that's where it really sort of hurts into their capital reserves. And so one of the things that you'll put into the presentation is one of the things that NIAC has sort of put up, and that's the National Association of Insurance Companies, is they put together what are guidelines, actuarial guidelines for insurance companies have to have capital reserves. And they're going to increase those capital reserves in this incoming environment. Whether they retroactively do that, we don't know. So some of that is there's some insurance companies that are at risk. So that you're going to hear more and more. We did put in here some of these insurance companies on some of the slides that are certainly a little bit, if this AG 38 comes into play, are going to be some of the ones that are affected. And I put that in slide 9 of ours is Lincoln, Manulife, which is John Hancock here in the United States, and Genworth. And it, depending on how severe or whether that's a retro look back, other companies like Principal and Hartford are also on that list of some of those insurance companies that from a financial perspective and using some of their capital reserves are going to be impacted. And there are others. I mean, obviously between Met and Prudential and some of these other there are other issues that they have. So capacity. So, again, we've got this exemption where there's 5 or 10, and people are looking at buying some large amounts of insurance. Well, if that becomes quite frankly, right, you would think, well, insurance companies would be happy to write a $30, $40, $50, $60 million insurance policy second to die for family living trust. Capacity becomes an issue because they can't put up the capital reserves. Cost them more money because they take that risk and they push it out to the Lloyds and second markets. So that costs them money to push that out. So as those capital reserves become more expensive and their rates become more and more, it's a capacity issue. So a lot of insurance companies have come back and said, we won't take more than $40 million, or we won't take more. Some of the insurance companies have put together what's called super pools, where they're starting to take together, where they're going to pool together some of their risk and look at doing some of those pieces. So believe it or not, there's a terrific opportunity here with regard to the situation. We get some clarity here on Tuesday. Obama gets reelected. Looks like the House and Congress stays the same. I think it's a little bit about nothing for the next 4 years. Everybody filibusters themselves, and we go sideways for a little while. And if that's the case, whether we kick the can or not, there's an opportunity, which is going to be very, very soon here. There will be, probably at one point or another, we'll have to bear with some of the revenue needs here as the deficit continues to increase. So I think, you know, timing is right to sort of start having those conversations. Insurance is certainly part of those. We wanted to sort of let you know, as sort of our expertise in this, is that obviously we're here to serve and to help facilitate those needs, which we know is only one part of the total estate piece. But to be aware of that, maybe dividing up some of the insurance among different providers and maybe not putting it all with one provider, not putting one single premium in, is what Ronnie was alluding to, and putting that in over a longer period of time. Again, the assets can be in the trust, so you're keeping the assets. And I talked about one of those strategies, the wait and see, which doesn't lock you into any one strategy. Talks a little bit about that and puts that in there, but allows you to sort of have that deduction, have that exemption, take advantage of the opportunity, but again, not having to sort of put all your eggs in one basket and have that planning be a one-time and lock yourself in for a 10, 20-year period. What the one, what's the saying, the one thing you can count on is change, and I think you're going to see some of that. Hopefully with what we have and our resources as the 11th largest insurance brokerage in the United States, we certainly have more than plenty of expertise in markets to help facilitate some of that.
Now, John, you make an excellent point that just goes beyond the immediate gifting issue, because these are things, that's why I'm saying it's not just stagnant on do we do the gifting. It's a lot of things coming into play. Those of you who have existing insurance trusts, have existing insurance, should be revisiting those policies that you're actually holding. Forget the issue of whether you're taking out a new policy now to take advantage of it, because you've got the John's point as to the health and viability of some of these existing policies and companies. So that you may want to take a look at. The other is you may be, say, bought a policy 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Guess what? You did it when you were a smoker. Now you haven't smoked for 5 years, and you're paying premiums that are based on the earlier health assessment. You may be able to revisit and get a lower rate and a better coverage based on the fact that the health time has distanced. Mortality tables, they've changed, which was another basis on which premiums have been determined. So certainly it's worth that look-see. One, for the health and safety of the company, and I believe your company will take a look at these with as a courtesy and help assess what they are.
We found a lot of people
take advantage of them.
We found a lot of people had sort of, you know, again, if you did this probably 15, 20 years ago, you had this insurance trust, a lot of people put and set the age to 95. Well, right, with mortality, right, we have more people who will be living to 100. So
I've seen policies where actually we have policies and they're expiring at 70 and 75, and I look at my client who's 72, and I said, gee, that's all you really have in mind, and that's assuming that they needed the insurance.
You're better than that.
You know, maybe we need to do this if they had a reason to have the insurance.
Well, as an accounting firm, one of the things that we recommend to our clients is that they work with their insurance advisors, and they get what we call in-force illustrations on an annual basis so that we examine it and take a look at it. You know, not only is all the stuff John's talking about important, new products come into play all the time. There are shifts. And sometimes there you have the abilities to do, you know, what we call tax-free exchanges, and, you know, upgrade our policies to get themselves more in line with what your needs are. You know, and we have, like, on our checklist of things that we look at every year, we tell our clients, let's get an in-force illustration. Some people, like John and his firm, are very good at this, and they do this stuff, you know, automatically. They do it on their own, and they're involved in their clients' lives. But unfortunately, there are a lot of insurance folks out there who sell products, and then they disappear. So it's incumbent upon us as planners to get out there and try to look at these things. Because we've seen Ronnie's situation that she expressed happen, unfortunately, more often than not. You get a client come in, and Ronnie will say, let's take a look at this thing. You know, and you'll have a client who's counting on this $10 million death benefit at the end of the day, regardless of when they die, to provide liquidity for an estate. And then you're looking at the thing, and economically, the policy doesn't sustain itself. And it's going to do what we call fall apart. And then all the, and clients don't know this. When clients bought and buy insurance, every one of them thinks they have something that's permanent no matter what. They all think it, every one of them. And it's incumbent upon us to bring this to their attention and help make sure that these things, you know, are in play.
Right. And there's a lot of different companies, and obviously some of that certainly changes. And some people say, well, I may become an uninsurable, I had stents, whatever that means. Again, there's a lot of, I'll give you, we're all kind of giving personal examples, and I'll give you probably one of my more interesting ones. Obviously, we have a lot of high net worth individuals here, celebrities, and we had one individual that we got insurance for that had, was obviously had some addiction issues, had a heroin conviction, had spent 2 years, three stents in a rehab, and we got him insurance. So, and I would say that exercise has not seen him in a long time. So, it wasn't pretty, but what I'm saying is, I guess, whatever you think your situation may or may not be, it's probably not as dire as that one. And, you know, part of it is that a lot of the companies have more and more deeper table shaving issues. So that if you have people, certainly, as we live longer, you're going to have issues, right? So at any one
point. Products do change, because I had clients I know at one point with where they would travel was a big factor, so they couldn't get life insurance because of risks of attacks and the like. The world has opened up and understood that now you can get these products. You may pay for it, but they are now available.
Right, and the answer is if you need to travel to those regions, you have to travel to those regions. That's part of what you do. But, again, it just depends on what appetite, what a carrier may have for one place or another. So, and, again, so I want to keep us. We're about 5 minutes
I wanted to make one other point on the insurance that I think is very important. You know, now with this $5 million exemption, as Ronnie was talking about, if we have a lot of dollars in these trusts that may be exempt from taxation for multiple generations, it's very important to consider life insurance as an asset class to, you know, to be held in these types of trusts. Obviously, the starting point is, are we going to need significant liquidity at the death of the first or the second spouse? But in addition to that, with this overlay of income tax rates going up significantly, the Medicare tax, income tax rates going up, you know, life insurance, when it's held inside of these trusts, it in effect grows income and estate tax free. And if you're looking at it in conjunction with, you know, a whole array of investments, it's important when you're working with a guy like John to take a look at it and say, you know what, if we what if the thing, what is the projected internal rate of return inside of our trust on an after income and estate tax basis? And look at it from an economic perspective. It's a wonderful hedge, you know, as well as other stocks, bonds, real estate, whatever else you're putting inside of these different trusts. And it's very important to consider it as just, you know, part of overall what we're looking at. Unfortunately, if somebody dies early on, you know, it, economically, you have a lot of infusion. But I found looking at these things, even if people, you know, live up to age 85 and 90, it still makes a lot of economic sense in a lot of cases. So just consider it when you do it.
Especially with the rates of return being what they are in other assets. That's the
only going to be probably about 10 or 15% of the total, in terms of total cash in the portfolio. But when you look at it, insurance company, or obviously the insurance lobby is relatively strong. It's one of the areas where this is probably one area that probably life insurance proceeds will always be tax-free. I shouldn't say that, knock on wood. That's probably not going to happen now. But for the most part, obviously, that's the one vehicle that you can really pass on to be tax-free. So it does have its use. Go ahead, we get the question.
Waiting patiently.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for this meeting. I think it was incredibly good. I wish you all had a little bit more time to speak. And a lot has been said about issues of transfer for the purposes of us not being here, giving to our families. But one thing you did speak about was the SLAT, which in essence, is, as I understand it, is a beneficial trust that I can set up for my wife or vice versa. And if we do it for each other, I'm concerned if you can, in very broad stroke, explain what you mean by somewhat different policies, because the last thing we want to do is trip up this year because we'll never be able to reestablish it. And the other question I have is for John, and that question is private letter insurance and putting businesses into it and splitting that business fund, the rest of this gifting, if you could quickly address that.
Let me take the first question, and John, you'll have the second. And the question, just to repeat, is the differentiation on the SLAT, the spousal lifetime annuity trust. I mentioned the reciprocal trust doctrine. Again, you have to vary the terms, because if you think about it, I'll use the vernacular of you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. If it looks like that, smells like that, you're going to have a problem, because the service will look at it as form over substance. And so what do we do? One example of a SLAT I had said is I create the trust for the lifetime of my husband and issue, and I have it fully discretionary to last for the lifetime of my husband. So how would I vary that if he were creating one for me? I might still have myself in as a discretionary beneficiary, and notice I do say discretionary because this is meant to be a safety valve. It is not meant to be a mandatory distribution, because it would defeat the tax purpose if we were looking at it from that myopic point of view. So I would have myself in. I might have my issue in. I might put charity in as another discretionary beneficiary class, so that differs from the other term. I might give the spouse, one spouse, a power of appointment, so that spouse would have the ability to appoint among, say, a class of people and not give it in the other. Some people vary the trustee. There is no, the problem is there is no hard and fast rule on what will give you the safety of not falling within the reciprocal trust. But there is enough case law and writing on it so that with these kinds of variations on things, you can do this. You might have perhaps some minimum distribution going out to an individual. Again, that's all I'm talking about. It's the dispositive terms, the provision, how the trust itself gets administered, who are the beneficiaries, and the like must vary. All right? They don't have to be absolutely different. And, for example, when I'm looking at what happens for the benefit of the descendants, those I tend to keep the same, subject to perhaps the power of appointment, because that's the one thing we want to have both parents in agreement as to what happens for the next generation. John, you have
the for the insurance and business trust, what I'll do is let me hit that with you one-on-one right after the meeting. Let me see if there's any other questions. I know we're right at 9:30, so people are just kind of running out, and I'll cover – I'll teach you right after this.
I think this is for Ronnie, and thanks very much. This is so informative. Let's say we were to buy a property with a child, and you have more than 50% of the ownership, and that has a mortgage on it. When that is trusted to the child or given to the child, then you have that mortgage. Would you continue with the mortgage? Is that then given to the child, but maybe you could give them the $13,000 a year to help with that? How do you deal with a property the child is living in that you have some ownership in?
That is, the question is, how do you deal with co-ownership on property with a child, particularly if it's subject to a mortgage? That sounds like a law professor's question. Okay, so I'm going to try and, in the short time, parse through certain things. One thing is, be careful if there is an existing mortgage on property that you are considering transfer. Make sure you are not triggering an acceleration event. You know, the bank, you're going to change title. Bank may not be so happy with you, and all of a sudden they're going to accelerate the mortgage. What type of property are we talking about? Are we talking real estate? Are we talking cooperative apartment? You know, you have different rules and different abilities to do transfers. You have a transfer into a trust if you're giving it directly to the child, or you're doing it subject to trust. The rules, if you have, if somebody dies owning property jointly with other than their spouse, and I'm not talking non-citizen spouses, you know, I could be lecturing for days if you want, but all these variations here. The general rule is that 100% of the property is included in your estate for estate tax purposes. So you've got to be so careful on how property is titled and the like. I'm dealing with an estate right now pulled for audit where the father, decedent, had gifted by putting a down payment down on the house but took title in his name as well as in the name of his son and the son and the son's wife. And how do we deal with it? There's a mortgage they took out. I mean, it's so complicated. I can address that with you, but be very, very careful.
Maybe we'll hit that afterwards as well.
Property where, you know, the value could be higher than the tax basis, and if the mortgage is higher than the income tax basis, you're triggering taxes on the transfer. Very, very careful with the transfer.
Right. The general rule is that mortgages, liens do run with the property itself, and then you get into the issue of servicing. One thing this lady said, and then we'll go to you, Karen, is that $13,000 is the annual exclusion amount through the end of the year. It will be adjusted for inflation to $14,000. So January 1, 2013, for 2013, the annual exclusion amount you can give to each individual without any gift implication will now be $14,000, doubling that. But with gift splitting, you have $28,000. Karen.
This is for Scott. I understand your comment about not converting to a Roth and pay taxes now versus 20 years from now. Is your opinion different if you know the IRA will not be touched and can become a stretch IRA? So if the beneficiaries, say they're 40 or 50 years old, right? Would it make more sense in that instance?
Yeah, we've run models on this for, you know, for many, many different types of people. And unfortunately, the answer is it might, and you really have to take a look at it. But I would say the situation, I'll give you the exaggerated example of where we've done it and it makes sense. It makes sense if you're a 40 or a 50-year-old, you have a dollar amount there, and you can tell me that you're never going to need the money. You know, and I look at paying the taxes on this IRA as, you know, pocket change. I'm never going to need it. I can pay the taxes from outside money, and then this money is going to grow for me, I'm never going to touch it, and then I'll be able to pass it on to my children and maybe even grandchildren, and I can take advantage of the tax-deferred nature of the thing for 40, 50, 60 years. In that example, to me, it's more of a no-brainer to do it, and I've had a couple of those. Other than that, because I have lots of people come in where they're going to need the money, and generally when you run these numbers, it does not make sense. Plus, you have no idea what they're going to do in terms of changing the law, and maybe you've paid something prematurely that could have some impact that that you may not have done it had you known.
I think I'm going to draw this to a close. There is breakfast out there, another cup of coffee. We will stay around so we can answer any additional questions. Thank you for coming out. Appreciate it. You're a good audience. Thank you.